Right.
Welcome and thank you for standing by. For the duration of today's conference, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. I'd like to inform all parties that today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the conference over to Dr. Meredith Lovelace. Thank you. You may begin.
Hello, welcome. I'm Meredith Lovelace. I'm a CMD with CGS Administrators, and I'm joined by contract medical directors from NGS, WPS, Noridian, and Palmetto, who welcome you to today's meeting. I thank all of our attendees and our panelists for taking time from your day and practices to be part of this process. This meeting is an evidence review meeting. It's part of the LCD modernization process as a result of 21st Century Cures Act that calls for local coverage determinations to be based on robust evidence review. The purpose of this meeting is for our expert panel to serve in an advisory capacity to review the quality of evidence that we would consider in development of an LCD. Our CAC is advisory in nature, and final decisions and issues rest with the MAC. Our experts represent a vast clinical experience, and since the process demands a focus on the evidence, we will ask all of our panelists to share evidence-based feedback. I also want to recognize there are many experts who are not on our panel today, and we have remote jurisdictional CAC members from across the country who are listening to this meeting. We want to make sure that you know that we value your input and feedback and that you are also part of this process. So for those who are not serving on the panel, if you could submit your comments in writing to your local MAC with a conflict of interest form, we can consider those comments. In addition, once a draft policy is developed and released, there will be an open comment period and opportunity to present at jurisdictional open meetings. All feedback from the comments and open meetings will be considered in the final policy development. On the screen, list all of the contract medical directors who are representing the MACs today and have worked hard in helping to get the panelists selected and here today and through this process. I'm now going to ask our panel to introduce themselves, to give a little bit of their background, and also declare any conflict of interest. And we'll go in the order that's on the slide, so starting with Brian Jacobs.
I'm Brian Jacobs. I'm a nurse anesthetist in Iowa. I'm here on behalf of the American Association of Nurse Anesthetists. I've completed one of our fellowships in pain management have been practicing pain management for the past 6 years. I'm also currently a PhD student in pain and associated symptoms research at the University of Iowa, if anyone needs a postdoc in the next year or two. Otherwise, I have no conflicts of interest to disclose.
Thank you. Dr. O'Brien?
Yeah, Dave O'Brien. I'm currently a Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation at Wake Forest University Baptist Health in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Finished my residency in PM&R in 1995 and did a sports and spine fellowship in 96. I've been director of an interventional spine and musculoskeletal fellowship since 2001 and continue that currently. As far as any disclosures, I actually have been a CAC advisor for American Academy of Physical Medicine Rehab with Palmetto for a number of years. I'm on the NASS Board of Directors for a number of years. I've also been on their coverage committee and currently still a senior reviewer for their coverage policies and also a CPT advisor at the AMA. I did do some work last year up until June with Turning Point Health Solutions, advising them about their policies and some reviews. Have not done that since June of last year. And I volunteer some for Spine Intervention Society, their health committee.
Thank you so much. Dr. Varghese?
Hi, thank you for having me. My name is Dr. Obi Varghese. I'm
Associate Professor of Clinical Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at the University of Missouri in Columbia, Missouri. I've been Medical Director of their pain management program for the last 15 years. I did my residency at University of Missouri and did my fellowship at Emory University before starting at the University of Missouri 15 years ago. I don't have anything to disclose.
Thank you. And Dr. Beal?
Yeah, Doug Beal. I'm an interventional radiologist practicing in Oklahoma City private practice. I am trained in radiology, interventional radiology, and have boarded certified in radiology and the interventional pain management, trained Georgetown Hopkins and Mayo Clinic. And I'm director of interventional spine services at Oklahoma Spine Hospital, director of the fellowship program. Conflicts of interest mainly include research and development with multiple medical device companies. I've got royalties from multiple textbooks and different publications in the past, and I've submitted all these in toto previously. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'm hoping Dr. Guller has been able to join us. We're having a little connection trouble.
She's still trying. It's Peter. I just got a text from her about 2 minutes ago. There's something going on where she's at, and cell phones and regular phones she can't get through. Linda, I don't know if you could call her and then maybe loop her into the conference.
I don't know if I can. I did talk to her, and I gave her our number to call. But I haven't heard back from her. She said she was going to call me back.
She's still getting the same message. She just texted me.
Okay. Linda, if you can please continue to work to get her connected, that would be great.
Okay.
Dr. Ward?
Hello. Good afternoon. My name is Michael Ward. I'm a clinical rheumatologist and clinical researcher. Focusing primarily on patients with axial spondyloarthritis. I had been in the past principal investigator for the American College of Rheumatology clinical practice guidelines for axial spondyloarthritis, and I have no conflict.
Thank you. And Dr. Vorenkamp? Dr. Vorenkamp won't be on today. Dr. Upadhyaya, have you been able to join us?
Yeah, I'm here. Upadhyaya.
Welcome. I'm glad you're
coordinated
in time.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just sitting in one of the clubs here.
You can just briefly introduce yourself and any conflicts of interest.
Yeah, I am a fellowship-trained spine neurosurgeon. I did my training at Michigan and UCSF. I do serve on various committees for AANS as well as CMS and spine section, and also an AMA CPT advisor. I have no other financial conflicts of interest in terms of industry funding.
Welcome. And Dr. Dubriel?
Yes, hi. I'm Maureen Dubriel. I'm a rheumatologist at Boston University School of Medicine and VA Boston. I am also a clinician and researcher focused in axial spondyloarthritis. I serve on the board for the Spondyloarthritis Research and Treatment Network, which is a nonprofit organization. And my only financial conflict of interest is an upcoming advisory board for UCB, Inc., pharmaceutical company. Thank you.
Thank you. And Dr. Cohen.
My name is Stephen Cohen. I'm the chief of pain medicine at Johns Hopkins and a professor of anesthesiology, neurology, physical medicine, and rehabilitation, and psychiatry and behavioral sciences. I'm also a director of pain research at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center and a professor there as well. And I, my conflict is I'm, I guess, the senior investigator on a on a multi-center study examining radiofrequency ablation for sacroiliac joint pain. That's in it's finished. It's in preparation, and it's was sponsored by Avidos. That money is paid to my institutions. Over.
Thank you so much. And have we had success in getting Dr. Galler connected yet? I'm not sure if there's a problem with her connecting since the operator had transferred. Had transferred off. So, Leisha, if there's any assistance that you can provide to Linda to get Dr. Galler connected, that would be great.
Yeah, I'm seeing if maybe we can add a line on a cell phone and try and get her in.
Okay. And if you are not currently speaking, if you could put your lines on mute, just so that we don't get any background noise. And our first question was for Dr. Galler, so I'm going to go ahead and we're going to move to the next. So for those, I'm Dr. Meredith Lovelace. I'll be moderating today, and I'm actually going to move to question number two, and then we'll come back to question one once we get Dr. Galler connected. So we're going to jump ahead. The question number two, I'll go ahead and read that, and should you evaluate for depression and treat prior to sacroiliac joint interventions? And Dr. Ward is going to open this question for us.
Yeah, so Michael Ward here. So of the literature that was provided, there were several articles that at least indirectly addressed this topic. But I will say that I didn't find anything that precisely addressed this specific topic. So going sort of in order, the treatment recommendations, the current recommendations from the North American Spine Society had several recommendations that were, as I said, indirectly related to the question of depression. And SI joint interventions, for example, they had a recommendation that non-structural causes of low back pain may be considered in patients with diffuse low back pain and tenderness, sort of a non-specific recommendation for how people should be evaluated. They had a recommendation that antidepressants are not recommended for the treatment of low back pain with a grade of A based on four randomized controlled clinical trials. They had a recommendation that cognitive behavioral therapy in combination with physical therapy provided benefits greater than physical therapy alone in pain relief. Grade A recommendation based on 11 randomized controlled trials. They had they reported that there was conflicting evidence on cognitive behavioral therapy alone in improving depression in patients with low back pain. So they did not provide a recommendation either for or against cognitive behavioral therapy in that condition. And lastly, they had a recommendation saying that there was insufficient evidence for or against the addition of cognitive behavioral therapy or psychosocial interventions for patients with for patients undergoing interventional or surgical treatment for low back pain. Saying that they didn't know or there was insufficient evidence to say that it would provide incremental benefit. So in summary, there were some recommendations that they had made that were indirectly related to this specific question, but in summary, my assessment of their recommendations was that there was no real added value in evaluating and treating depression before SI joint interventions. There was a second article of recommendations by the American Society of Interventional Pain Physicians, and their guidelines made no mention of depression or psychosocial interventions at all. And thirdly, the appropriateness criteria reported by the Spine Intervention Society also made no mention of screening or treatment of depression prior to SI joint injections or interventions. There was one primary research article by Cohen. I guess you're on the call. Maybe that's you. evaluated non-organic signs, for example, non-anatomical tenderness or discrepant physical exam, and found that these features were not associated with the quality or magnitude of treatment response to SI joint interventions. And lastly, I would just comment, going over the trials that were included in the literature review, there were at least three trials which excluded patients with untreated depression as part of their inclusion criteria. All of those three were for radiofrequency ablation evaluations, but none of the observational studies that were listed there had any exclusions based on pre-existing depression or untreated depression. So I guess in my summary of this literature is that there's no evidence to support the treatment of depression or evaluation for depression prior to instituting SI joint intervention.
Thank you so much for that thorough evaluation. And do any of the other panelists want to add anything to this question?
Yes, this is Stephen Cohen. Not throwing anyone under the bus, but I was actually asked to comment on this question as well. So, and I guess it was based on a study that we had that was just published, very, very large, 9 centers, 346 patients who received procedures for back pain, including sacroiliac joint pain. And I guess I was asked because the results were actually stratified based on the degree of depression. So people who were not depressed, 57% had a positive categorical outcome, and then it almost linearly declined. So people who are mildly depressed, 46%, people who are moderately or severely depressed, 36%, and if you were very severely depressed, this is based on quick inventory of depressive symptomatology quids, it was actually less than 20%. And if you look very strongly at the literature between things like depression, anxiety, sleep, it's clear that, you know, having chronic pain can cause people to not sleep well and be depressed. But actually, it's a bidirectional relationship, and the reverse is more true. So people who are depressed or don't sleep well and injure themselves are more likely to not get better with interventions, including, procedures. So, and almost every really high-quality, federally funded study that's looking at efficacy excludes people with poorly controlled symptomatology. So I agree. This is an area that's kind of high-risk, high-reward. But I don't think that everyone needs a depression inventory or quids, you know, before they undergo a procedure. But if you're you know, if you're a doctor and someone is severely depressed, they're way more likely to not get better. That is the strongest predictor out of over 30 predictors that were looked at in this study that had 350 patients. I think it's a really simple thing to you know, ask people if you're depressed. I mean, even if you're a family doctor, you should ask people if they're depressed, especially when it can have a profound effect on something that you do. Over.
Can I, this is Chirag. Would I be able to ask a question, or?
Yes.
Would there be a recommendation, or is there Cohen, based off what you were saying in terms of screening patients for depression with a formal screening exam or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that a lot of people are not really trained to screen people, you know, who are depressed. What do you do if they're depressed? We always have problems because if they answer, you know, I do lots and lots of clinical trials. I have about $20 million as PI in federal grants. And if somebody has a, you know, test positive on a suicide question or they answer something affirmatively, you know, it's a big, huge problem. We have to do a lot of things, and I'm not sure that everyone is trained to do it. But I think a really simple thing, you know, how are you feeling? Are you depressed? Are you sleeping well? You know, these are really basic things that one might argue every single doctor should be asking a patient, certainly a pain doctor, right? That's why, you know, pain medicine is a recognized specialty by ACGME for psychiatry. It's a subspecialty training. So I don't think that they need to fill out a questionnaire. But I think people who have poorly controlled depression, you know, should probably be evaluated. I don't think that somebody who's undergoing elective surgery for back pain who has poorly controlled depression, I think most surgeons would not operate, or most ethical surgeons would not operate until this is direct. And, you know, like I said, you can be, you know, it might be that these people never become not depressed, but at least it doesn't have to be uncontrolled, very severe depression. It'd be a very, very simple thing.
Thank you so much. And I'm going to check in if we were able to connect with Dr. Guller.
I do think we have the operator trying to dial out to Dr. Guller and
okay.
To see if that worked. I don't know if it's worked yet.
This is Dr. O'Brien. I thought Dr. Cohen brought up a lot of great points. I guess the question is, for the purpose of this specific subject for depression evaluations prior to the treatment of SI joint interventions, is there be a formal criteria to evaluate for depression? Or I think that most of us that practice pain and musculoskeletal medicine screen for this indirectly when we meet with patients, and it's just part of our practice that if we see somebody that's severely depressed and has a lot of other issues, we get that addressed and figure how that plays in our treatment algorithm. But I'm not sure, as far as a coverage policy, what should be required or not required, and just asking the rest of the panel and Steve in particular if there should be something specific worded that should be mandated as part of a coverage policy for SI injections and procedures that should be required or not.
I wish I was in, this is Steve Cohen again, I wish I was an expert, but we were, you know, I have a joint appointment in the Department of Psychiatry at Johns Hopkins. They have an inpatient pain unit. It's a very complicated thing because when people go to that inpatient pain unit, it's covered under psychiatric benefits. And, you know, a lot of the people, they're getting their depression and their, you know, substance misuse disorder, under control, and you know these are very smart people who run the program, and they say, you know, while they're it's easier to get it under control if you can treat concomitant pain problems. you know, it's hard to come out with a general policy, right, because there are always going to be exceptions. I would hate to say that everyone has to get, like, an inventory and be screened for suicide, but I think that really in some way, again, I am not an expert on this, you know, that severe depression or poorly controlled depression, you know, should be addressed before people get procedures, because they're very unlikely to get better. And, you know, like I said, that's kind of a common thing that people see in psychiatry and general medicine. People have diffuse, you know, pain problems. You know, it's very difficult to explain them. And then when it's explored further, it turns out, you know, that you know, their husband, their wife just left them, their kid dropped out of school, and they lost their job. And when this gets, it just makes things worse. So I wish I had an answer to this, bringing this up, and I don't.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great point. So I guess my proposal would be perhaps drafting some language to the point that patients that are being considered for these interventional psychiatric procedures should have any coexisting psychological or depression related illnesses stabilized and prior to considering moving forward, something to that effect. That, in other words, everybody's got depression nowadays. So, but there's a difference between having controlled, stable mental illness that people should undergo appropriate treatments for versus people that are psychologically or emotionally unstable. So maybe some wording that patients that are being considered for these procedures should be emotionally and psychologically stable. And if not, that those things should be addressed perhaps prior to proceeding with any of these interventions. I don't know if that would be appropriate or not.
Can I make a comment? This is Dr. Burgess. So it's been my experience that if somebody presents with major depressive disorder that's active, they rarely present with just SI joint pain, very focused, you know, isolated low back pain that would present for what we're talking about today. Oftentimes these patients present with, like Dr. Cohen mentioned, diffuse widespread pain. And in that situation, we're kind of getting off topic. If somebody presents with depression and they're not suicidal, and they have very focused SI joint pain with, as the literature demonstrates, you know, 3+ provocative maneuvers with high confidence, it's very safe to do an SI joint injection to demonstrate if they actually present with SI joint pain. You may or may not have to do 2 blocks based on the literature. But if you're talking about a patient who presents with widespread pain or diffuse pain with active depression, that's a totally different thing compared to what we're talking about today, in my opinion.
I think that some really valid and interesting discussion, and I think we could probably talk about this our whole meeting, because it's I'm going to ask if we have additional comments on this to submit it in writing so we can move forward. If there's a wrap-up comment, that's fine, and then we're going to move to questions to be able to make sure we cover everything.
Yeah, this is Chirag. I just wanted to carry Dr. Burgess's point just to one extension, which is that, you know, some of the later questions start devolving into SI joint fusion. And I think, you know, there could be a little bit of a distinction also made between patients for when it comes to this question of depression injection versus what would effectively be a permanent change in the patient's biomechanics and bony anatomy with a fusion. So if they, you know, thinking about it from that depression standpoint as well, but I won't belabor it any more than that.
Well, I think it's a valid point too. Thank you. And I'm going to go to question number 3. Which I'm going to turn over to you.
Yeah, thank you. The question I had with this one, at least, was with the obese patient, what should be done prior to injection or radiofrequency treatment? You know, so having gone through everything, the approach that I had regarding the obese patient was, should anything be done in terms of considering weight loss or any of those sorts of factors? when it comes specifically to the obesity, and I couldn't really find any good evidence for against. I mean, it really just seemed like it wasn't something that when I was doing the literature search, identified a ton of direct, useful, scientifically structured information. I did email to everybody, and I can just quickly run through it. There was an article about the technical difficulties, and there were several articles that would suggest that, you know, there were some technical challenges with ultrasound guidance. And Wang, for example, described, you know, potentially using a CT if you've got patients who have some degree of obesity. There was another one just in general with SI joint pain, considering weight loss as a way of managing the SI joint pain. And then, again, a series of articles regarding the technical challenge, particularly with some of the ultrasound-guided techniques with a certain level of obesity. And I think, you know, the cutoffs seem to be somewhere around 30 to, you know, 35, although I'm sure we all know that the distribution of the obesity is going to make a difference as well when it comes to the technical challenge of placing it. I think that would basically summarize it. What I had hoped to find was evidence that said, okay, you know, something about weight loss that, you know, either for or against or non-value, but I just didn't find any good information when it comes to injection or radiofrequency treatment.
Thank you.
So I hate to do this, but these were the two points that I was asked to comment on, you know, by the committee. So this is Stephen Cohen. I just wanted to point, so that's, you know, great presentation. I wanted to point out that in that same featured article in Regional Anesthesia and Pain Medicine with 9 centers, that obesity was also a really, really strong predictor of treatment failure. However, that being said, I think it's a slippery slope to withhold treatment from people who are overweight. And I do also think that, you know, the effective treatment of back pain can facilitate participation in exercise programs and social functioning. Over.
Yeah, Dr. Cohen, I think I found your article as well, and I did go past it relatively quickly. But I think the perspective that I was approaching when it comes to this particular question was, and I agree that it did suggest that there was a failure. It was more if you treat the obesity or lose some weight, focusing on the word prior in the question, would that then change anything versus, you know, as you rightfully pointed out, would you withhold the treatment even if there's a chance of failure? So fair point, and I appreciate the comment.
Thank you very much for that discussion. And I know that they're working with Dr. Guller to utilize a different line. Has that been successful?
So far, we have not had any success. I think the last thing was to see if Dr. Guller had a landline to use. The operator was not able to get through.
Okay. And I know Mark is working with her as well. So we'll continue to work on getting her on and move over to question 4. Dr. Dubrell, if you could address question 4 for us. Dr. Dubrell?
Yes, I'm sorry. So this question addresses the need for a trial of 2 classes of medications prior to an SI joint procedure or a trial of physical therapy. In regards to the question about medication treatment, I found no studies evaluating specifically SI joint pain and pharmacotherapies. What I did find was guidelines related to treatment of nonspecific low back pain, both from NASS and the ACP, American College of Physicians. In terms of the Spine Society recommendations, there are 3 recommendations in favor of medication therapies, grade A being the highest recommendation for topical capsicum for 3 months or less, grade B recommendations in favor of non-selective NSAIDs, and for cautiously limited and short-duration opioids. There were recommendations indicating insufficient evidence or against topical lidocaine, anticonvulsants, antidepressants, and oral and intravenous steroids, and the NASS document did not address muscle relaxants. In terms of the ACP guidelines, which were from 2017, acute low back pain was recommended to be treated with non-pharmacologic therapies first, including heat massage, acupuncture, and spinal manipulation. If patient and clinician dyads preferred pharmacologic therapy, the recommendation was for NSAIDs first or for muscle relaxants. They found moderate quality evidence, and this was a strong recommendation. For chronic low back pain, with the definition being 4 weeks or longer, the recommendation was, again, to start with non-pharmacologic therapies, including exercise, rehab, acupuncture, mindfulness-based stress reduction, or cognitive behavioral therapy. And if those were inadequate, then to move on to medications, which included NSAIDs as first line, and then second line, tramadol specifically, or duloxetine. My recommendation and interpretation of these two leading society guidelines is that the only recommendation in common is for NSAIDs. I think it would be reasonable to try the recommendations that each society recommended separately, so topical capsicum, short duration limited opioids, or non-benzodiazepine muscle relaxants, but I do not think it's reasonable to require a trial of 2 classes because the guidelines are not, there are no 2 classes that are consistently recommended across professional societies. Do we want to pause and discuss medications briefly and then move on to physical therapy?
Yeah, this is Dave O'Brien. I'm kind of hesitant to require, I think, a multimodal approach to conservative treatment is appropriate, and that can include medicines or no medicines and therapy and so forth. I do believe therapy should be tried personally. But, you know, some people cannot tolerate NSAIDs. They have comorbid issues such as hypertension, renal disease, that might be a bad idea. Also, the NASS guidelines that are being referred to are really just lumping everything into low back pain. So it's not specific to this, issue of SI joint pain. And so that should be taken into some consideration, that these were guidelines based on just low back pain literature, which encompasses a lot of things. So I just think, as far as the coverage policy, that they should fail conservative treatment, or conservative treatment should be tried, and that should include physical therapy with or without appropriate pharmacologic interventions based on the individual patient.
This is Brian Jacobs. I agree. For some of our patients, I'm not sure that pharmacologic therapies should even be considered conservative therapy. And a lot of these patients are already on some of these medications before they get to our clinic. So I'm not sure it would be prudent to trial them on a new muscle relaxant or a new NSAID just to get them to the point of interventional care.
Any other comments about medications? Okay, I'm going to move on and just briefly summarize the literature regarding physical therapy. This was addressed by a 2017 systematic literature review by Al Subahi and colleagues in the Journal of Physical Therapy Science. In total, they found 9 studies that met their inclusion criteria. There were 3 studies of exercise, 3 of kinesiotape, and 4 that included manipulation. Only one of these studies, and it was one of kinesiotape, compared the intervention to a placebo or sham treatment. So almost all of these, we're comparing active treatments to each other. And therefore, it's very difficult to quantify the effect that physical therapy has relative to not doing physical therapy. However, the author's conclusions from this systematic review were that physical therapy is effective in reducing pain and disability in SI joint dysfunction. Subsequent to this systematic review, there were two other studies that I was able to find published later, 2019 study by Kamali et al., which was a trial comparing different physical therapy modalities, so again, comparing active treatments. This compared exercise to manipulation. Participants were required to have a minimum duration of pain, I think of a few months, but in reviewing their table one, most people had pain lasting 4 years, which is an indication, I think, of a very long natural history of SI joint pain for many people. With both of these interventions, the mean improvement in VAS measured pain was 60%. They also had improvements in the Oswestry Disability Index over 40%, and there was no difference between the treatment groups. A 2021 trial by Javadov et al. Compared three treatment groups. One was manual therapy and home-based SI joint exercise. The second group was manual therapy and lumbar exercise, and the third group was lumbar exercise alone. This study included only women. They were required to have a minimal VAS pain score of 3 and at least one and a half months of pain. All three groups had reductions in pain, but the reductions were greater for those that included manual therapy. And those in group one, which is manual therapy and home-based SI joint exercise, had the greatest improvements of pain. They also had resolution of most of their provocative SI joint tests and reductions in disability. So my interpretation of these data overall is that there's generally low quality data just because of comparing active interventions to each other, but the existing body of evidence does support physical therapy as an effective intervention in reducing SI joint pain and disability.
Thank you so much. And for the discussion, I also am interested if our subject matter experts, if anyone disagrees on a minimum of 4 weeks of non-invasive conservative therapy for SIJ pain, and if so, why?
This is David Bryan. No, I don't disagree with the 4 weeks. I would, however, I'm not sure about requiring physical therapy. There's been some studies showing that physician-directed home exercise program is often as effective as some formal physical therapy. And now with technology and Epic, and you're allowed to, it's much easier to print out exercises, review those with the patient, how to do them at home. And they got YouTube videos and links you can give patients now. So for patients who are traveling to a physical therapist's office is financially or physically difficult, I think that should be a reasonable alternative would be to require physical therapy or a physician-directed exercise and treatment program is reasonable.
Thank you so much. And we're going to continue, Dr. Dubrel, with Dr. Ward to discuss question number 5. And this is the role of an injection or radiofrequency ablation of the SI joints in management of inflammatory arthritis forms, such as axial ankylosing spondylitis, psoriatic, or other spondyloarthropathies. And so our rheumatology experts will take over here.
Yeah, so this is Mike Ward. And Maureen and I will split this question. So our primary source here was the current American College of Rheumatology treatment guidelines for axial spondyloarthritis that specifically addressed the role of sacroiliac joint injections with local glucocorticoids. And the population under consideration by this group was patients with ankylosing spondylitis who had isolated active sacroiliitis despite treatment with NSAIDs. And then the question was, is treatment with locally administered glucocorticoids more effective than no treatment with locally administered glucocorticoids? And the recommendation based on the systematic literature review through 2019 was conditionally in favor of local glucocorticoids in this patient population based on, unfortunately, very low quality evidence, the primary evidence being two small randomized controlled trials, one of which was non-blinded and therefore high risk of bias, but both of which demonstrated substantial reductions in pain over a follow-up of anywhere from 1.5 to 18 months. Maureen?
Thank you. So I'll just summarize the observational and open label studies that were included in that ACR guideline review. There were observational studies comprised 268 patients and 457 SI joint injections, I believe. And among these studies, there was a significant improvement in pain in over 90% of those who received injections. The mean duration of response was 8 months. And of those observational studies, several of them demonstrated improvements of bone marrow edema on MRI, improvements in inflammatory markers, and reductions in NSAID use, leading to this ACR recommendation conditionally in favor. So my interpretation of these data are that SI joint injections are a reasonable adjunctive treatment to systemic therapies for axial spondyloarthritis among those who have sacroiliitis as their predominant or only feature while they're awaiting the effect of systemic therapy. SI joint injections could also be a reasonable option for those with spondyloarthritis who have some contraindication to escalating therapy or starting therapy, systemic therapy. So that could include people who are pregnant or those who have had a severe infection. It is my opinion that SI joint injections are not a reasonable monotherapy for individuals who have spondyloarthritis and have involvement somewhere outside of the SI joint. So those folks would require systemic therapy unless there's some contraindication to everything else. And Dr. Ward, did you have any other comments or any other interpretations?
No, I completely agree. We think this is useful adjunctive, particularly if, you know, the SI joint is sort of involved and painful out of proportion to the rest of the axial skeleton or peripheral joints, and there is some reason why systemic treatment either can't readily be given at a particular time or there's some temporary contraindication.
Thank you so much. And do any of our other panelists have any comments to add?
I do. This is Doug Beal. I want to add a level one trial. This is an open-labeled randomized controlled trial by Zeng, and this was done in 2014, 155 patients, and these are primarily axial low back pain or selected for SI joint pain by at least a 50% response to a fluoroscopically guided SI joint injection randomized to RFA. Or celecoxib, so Celebrex is the other arm, and followed out to 6 months resulted in a statistically significantly better improvement in pain at a very high level of statistical significance as compared with the celecoxib arm. And this is a level one open label RCT.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Before we move to the next question, Dr. Guller is unable to connect, so she is sending her response to Dr. Goldberg, one of our CMDs. And Peter, has she been able to send that to you yet?
No, I have not received it yet, but she did mention she will be sending it to me.
Okay, so once she receives that, just let me know and we'll go back up to that first question.
Very good.
So if no other comments on question five, we'll move to question six. And to all of our panelists for the articles that are mentioned, like the Zhang 2014 and several of the physical therapy articles you mentioned, Dr. Burrell, and throughout, if you could kindly send me those references, if you just send the reference, the name, I can pull the articles, but if we can get those, that's important that we have the accurate reference that you're referring to, because we appreciate you identifying those sources for us. So for the next question, I'm going to turn this over to Dr. O'Brien, and this is regarding the ICD-10 codes that you feel are appropriate for SIJ joint injections or RF, and the ICD-10 code or the CPT code 64625. Which is the code for radiofrequency ablation of the SIJ joint. Let's go ahead and have that included in here so this would also include 64625 in the question. And over to you, Dr. Brian.
Yeah, so the question is, do you feel there is sufficient evidence to support the following diagnosis ICD-10 codes for SI joint injections and or RFA, and again, you added that additional CPT code, which is appropriate for SI joint RF, to that list. For the first one, sacroiliitis, not otherwise classified, I thought that was appropriate. The next two would include spondylosis without myelopathy or radiculopathy, lumbar or lumbosacral. I thought those should be excluded, as the next one, spondylosis without myelopathy or radiculopathy sacral. The sacrococcygeal joint region more accurately describes a problem in the sacral region. And then the second part of that question was, do you agree that there's insufficient evidence to support the following diagnosis codes for SI joint injections and RFA? And again, those diagnoses listed were more lumbar-related due to lumbar stenosis, radiculopathy, the sacrococcygeal joint specifically, which is not the SI joint, trochanteric bursitis of the hips is not SI, specifically an SI problem, and post-laminectomy syndrome is not necessarily a SI joint problem. Neither is fracture of lumbar vertebrae or degenerative disc disease, interventricular disc degeneration. So I thought those should be excluded, and I did add in my email six new diagnoses, ICD-10 codes that I thought would be appropriate, and that included M46.1, which is sacroiliac inflammation, the code also for arthritis of the sacroiliac joint, ankylosis of the sacroiliac joint, degenerative joint disease of the SI joint, disorder of the sacroiliac joint, and then chronic sacroiliac pain. So I thought those were appropriate ICD-10 codes to add to the list of codes that should be appropriate for these procedures.
Thank you very much. And if our panelists have any additional thoughts on these codes or the additional codes that Dr. O'Brien brought up, their appropriateness, please comment.
This is Brian Jacobs. I agree with excluding the codes Dr. O'Brien identified and including the six new codes related to the sacroiliac joint.
And for sake of time, does anyone disagree? Well, that was simpler than I expected. Thank you, Dr. O'Brien.
Meredith, it's Peter. I have Padma's response for the first question.
Great. Well, then let's go ahead. If there's no additional comments on question number six, we're going to return to question number one. And
for question.
So if Peter, if you could start with that first question, and then Dr. Beal and Dr. Dubrail will follow.
Sure. So for the first question, is physical exam findings consistent with SI joint dysfunction, which may lead to intervention? In 15 to 30% of chronic low back pain patients, especially those that are older, the SI joints are often the cause of pain. Common symptoms include maximal pain below L5 vertebral body, pain aggravated with sitting and transition to sitting and sitting to standing, referred pain to the buttocks, groin, thigh, and occasionally below the knee. Patients with a history of lumbar sacral trauma or history of procedures such as fusion are often plagued with lumbar sacral pain. Physical exam demonstrates Fortin's point, that is localized tenderness with palpation of the sacral sulcus. Physical exam maneuvers that provoke SI joint-related pain include the Faber test, the Gantlin, thigh thrust, sacral thrust, distraction, and compression. No single test has a high predictive value for diagnosing SI joint pain. It has been reported in the evidence that a history of maximum pain below L5 and a positive finding of at least 3 of the 6 of the above tests predict a 70 to 80% likelihood of a positive response to a diagnostic intra-articular SI joint block. The standard of diagnosis of SI joint pain remains a positive response to fluoroscopy-guided intra-articular injection of local anesthetic. And she does have a list of references to support her argument.
Thank you. And is there any comments on this portion before we move to the next section?
Yeah. Thank you.
All right, Dr. Beal.
Okay, so this is the use of the imaging for SI joint pain and dysfunction. So in general, this can be helpful to confirm the degenerative changes, but degenerative changes are not necessarily helpful in confirming pain. These are abnormal. This is seen really early on. Cohen described this up to 25% of everybody on plain film evaluation at age 50, and then Vogler described it as 77% by early age of 30. So this is not particularly helpful in assessing degenerative changes. CT scanning has a little bit of limited value in correlating pain versus appearance based on a low sensitivity and specificity. MRI is especially helpful for neoplastic disease and to detect inflammatory arthropathies, spinal arthropathies, infection, tumors. Nuclear medicine bone scanning is has been shown by Kurt Slipman in Maine to have a low sensitivity but a high specificity. And although none of the modalities are very good for correlating with pain, these are especially helpful when excluding such things as trauma, stress fractures, inflammatory change, and cancer involvement. So also second category here, given the fact that transitional lumbar sacral anatomy is about 15% of the population, and sacral dysplasia has been reported in up to 26% of the population. These things are almost as common as the incidence of blue eyes in the United States. And so to be able to have adequate evaluation of this CT and MRI, the cross-sectional evaluation for intervention is very important, and to be able to determine, especially if you go into SI joint fusion, where you would fuse and what this looks like in the presence of that transitional lumbar sacral anatomy. So in summary, imaging is useful for patients with stress fractures, trauma, inflammatory changes, neoplastic involvement, and infection, but not especially helpful in separating out patients who have painful degenerative changes versus those who do not have pain from their degenerative changes. And also, given the variable anatomy of the sacrum and the imaging and the variability of this SI joint itself, imaging is very helpful for interventional treatments and for SI fusion.
Thank you very much. And do we have any additional comments on this question?
I think Dr. Beal brings out a good point that although imaging may not diagnose SI joint pain, it's very useful at evaluating for other sources of sacral pain that may mimic SI joint pain for many of the reasons he just mentioned.
Thank you. And I'll turn it over to Dr. DeBrail.
Okay, thank you. So I'll first address evaluation for infection, which is just the simpler of those two questions. In regards to data supporting a strategy for evaluating for infection, I was able to find no literature supporting either patient factors or a specific strategy for evaluating for infection among people presenting with SI joint pain. So my comments are related to my clinical experience and training. In terms of people who should be evaluated for SI joint infection, there are individuals who have subacute or acute onset of severe, typically unilateral buttock pain with exam findings that suggest SI joint dysfunction, as we just addressed at the top of this question. Typically, they have other signs of infection, either by physical exam or laboratory studies or imaging. They may be individuals who have risk factors for infection, such as those who are immunocompromised, have known exposures to TB, risks for brucellosis. They may have risk for hematogenous seeding or direct infection of the SI joint, very rarely. If people have this concern for infection, they should go on to have an evaluation with soft tissue imaging that can image both the SI joint but also the surrounding soft tissues. And if there's a fluid collection, they would go on to have an image-guided joint aspiration or aspiration of that fluid collection. In terms of evaluation for inflammatory disease, the family of diseases under consideration is termed axial spondyloarthritis. So this includes the prototypic form of disease, which is ankylosing spondylitis. For these folks, the predominant feature is inflammatory back pain, so an inflammatory pattern to their back and buttock pain or other axial pain due to inflammation at the sites of tendon attachments throughout the spine, with the SI joint being one of the most common sites. These folks do warrant systemic treatment because of the risk for going on to develop permanent bony damage at other sites and highly effective therapies that are available. And so for individuals who develop axial or buttock pain before the age of 45, so this includes adults and children, or people who have common extra-spinal manifestations of spondyloarthritis, being inflammatory bowel disease, psoriasis, or eye inflammation, uveitis or iritis, they should go on to have an evaluation, ideally by a rheumatologist or another clinician who's experienced in diagnosing spondyloarthritis. And typically this evaluation would include systemic inflammatory markers, as well as a pelvic MRI with specific sequences and HLA-B27 genetic testing. Be happy to hear comments.
Thank you for that thorough answer for all three of our panelists. And Dr. Guller, if she can hear us, for her contribution to that question. Are there any other comments on question one? Then we are going to speed ahead to back to question number seven, and this is for Dr. Cohen. This question has multiple parts. Turn this over to you, Dr. Cohen.
Thank you. I'll try to answer all the parts. Does the evidence support single diagnostic injections or multiple, and what's the therapeutic cutoff? And then I'll go over outcomes. So without a reference standard, you know, the validity and accuracy of diagnostic injections is always speculative. So for prognostic purposes, you know, the false positive rate varies based on many factors. The placebo response rate, and there are seven SI joint studies that report false positive rates by doing two blocks. And if you throw out the two outliers on both sides, the median is around 30%. So that's very similar to what you see with lumbar facet blocks. But you also have spread of injectate to other pain-generating structures. So for almost all diagnostic procedures, almost every single one, lower blocks are more specific, you know, using sedation, superficial anesthesia. So for conditions with a low prevalence or pretest probability, like, let's say, lumbar facet pain in younger people, the chance of a positive block being false positive is higher than a positive block being a true positive, right? Because so for SI joint pain, a lot of it depends on how you select patients. So you can increase the pretest probability by selecting patients for diagnostic blocks with multiple provocative tests. And although many studies report this, not all do. There are several that don't, including that recent 2022 Nine Center study. The other problem with doing two blocks is that when they classify a block as false positive, it's usually a block that's positive and then a block with negative. So the only data that we have on this is by Rick Derby back in 2013 for lumbar facet pain, and he found actually false negative rates of 47%. And he used 75% as a cutoff, but it was 47% when you know, for people who had less than 50% relief and people who had between 50 and 74% relief. If you look at the randomized controlled trials for SI joint fusion, these are almost all industry-sponsored, and almost every single one of them used a single block with 50% threshold, and they all reported positive outcomes. So clearly, you know, if people are using one block with 50% pain relief for surgery, which has very significant risks and costs, many people would construe it as being inconsistent for doing it with something like radiofrequency ablation, which is, you know, cheaper and less risky. If you look at the it depends on what your goal is. So clearly, if the goal is to maximize patient benefit and access to care, you would never do two blocks. So I had been the chair of the cervical and lumbar facet guidelines. So those had 14 and 17, you know, international organizations, including the U.S. Departments of Defense and Veterans Affairs. And it was concluded both times that only one block. If you look at the therapeutic cutoff of 50 versus 75%, there are old guidelines that were initially kind of developed for lumbar facet joint pain from the 1990s from SIS, and they said, you know, you should have almost 100% relief. For SI joint, in the book from 2013, which is being revised now by Milan Stojanovic, they said that less than 50% is a negative block. 50 to 74% might or might not be a positive block. It's equivocal, and greater than 75% is a positive response. But, again, these were kind of developed in the 1990s. And the impact guidelines, which came out, and these are followed by the FDA and the European Medicines Agency in almost all studies, they consider a 30% or a two-point decrease in pain to be clinically meaningful. So if you look at the randomized trials for SI joint pain, I will go over. So you have Marger's study. They considered 50 to 70% as fair results, over 70% relief as good results, and they used 1 month outcome. If you look at the two Leukanen studies, right, so these are periarticular SI joint injections, they didn't have a categorical outcome measure, but they used 1 month. So that was their endpoint. If you look at the largest study, so randomized trial in Mayo Clinic proceedings from 2019, we used a two-point or greater decrease in pain at 1 month and positive satisfaction. And if you look at that RAPM study that we were talking about, we also used 50% or greater pain relief lasting at least 1 month. And coincidentally, we found that if you had between 50 and 79% immediate relief after the procedure, that you were more likely to have a positive outcome at 1 month than if you had 80% or greater relief. There's, about 20 studies that have looked at, difference in the outcome of a definitive procedure like radiofrequency, and stratified by the results of the prognostic block. So it's been done for cervical facet radiofrequency, that's us, for celiac plexus neurolysis, that's MyGurdick, for lumbar facet radiofrequency multiple times, including by me and Milan Stojanovic, who's the editor-in-chief of the SIS's new pain journal, Coyote Williams for spinal cord stimulation, for SI joint radiofrequency by us, for pulsed radiofrequency, like almost across the board. And almost all have found there is no difference in long-term outcomes between cutoff of 50% and cutoff at 75 or 80%. One of the only studies that did find a statistically significant difference in favor of a higher outcome was by our group. Ian Chen is the first author, 265 patients for genicular nerve radiofrequency ablation. And the issue with genicular nerve blocks is that they have no diagnostic value. They're purely prognostic, and almost everybody has a positive block. So going back, if you look at the radio frequency studies, the first placebo control trial looking at SI joint radio frequency ablation, the criteria were 75% or greater relief after a single injection, and a positive outcome was 50% or greater relief plus positive patient global impression of change at 3 months. Nilesh Patel's also a randomized controlled trial. They used greater than 75% pain relief after two lateral branch blocks, and a positive outcome was greater than 50% pain relief or 10-point or greater reduction in ODI at 3 months. So again, 3 months. Van Tilburg's placebo control trial is the only negative one for radiofrequency. They used a 2-point decrease in pain from a single SI joint injection to select patients, and their outcome was a 2-point or greater decrease in pain. They didn't say when their primary endpoint, but they allowed people to cross over 3 months. So again, 3 months. The JUICE study, right, so that's the MINT study, they selected patients greater than 50% pain relief from lateral branch block. Their primary endpoint was 3 months, and a positive outcome was greater than 2-point decrease in pain. That was also positive for the SI joint. The META study, again, randomized control, they were more selective. They used greater than 80% pain relief after two intra-articular injections, which is a little strange because, the lateral branches that are targeted for radiofrequency ablation, they don't innervate the joint capsule. They innervate the ligament. So that has to be very clear. So it's a little inconsistent, but their primary endpoint was 3 points. And they didn't have an outcome measure, but they considered 2-point reduction overall as the minimal clinically important difference between groups. And finally, our study, so this is in preparation, but it's the largest randomized trial, and it's 210 patients. There were 17 or 19 sites. The selection criteria was greater than 50% pain relief after SI joint injections and lateral branch blocks, and greater than 2-point decrease in pain at 3 months, and a positive patient global impression of change. So that was a positive outcome. So it seems to be for radiofrequency, 3 months, and that's consistent with the lumbar and cervical facet guidelines and my other disclosures that I had been the chair of those guidelines. Usually between 30% and 50% pain relief. If you try to extrapolate to other conditions, I'll just give you examples. Like the big epidural steroid injections that were published in New England Journal of Medicine, 3 and 6 weeks. The Friedley study, also published in the New England Journal of Medicine, NIH, their primary endpoint for a steroid injection was 6 weeks. There's a study that's finished They're looking at the data. They worked with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. They're trying to get, a company is trying to get the first ever steroid approved for epidural use. They're called Skylex, and the FDA said 4 weeks is a reasonable outcome. So, you know, as I said, so radio frequency and the use of 3 weeks was based on a study that we had done where we did surveys of patients and physicians before a very, very large randomized trial, and 3 months was considered reasonable. Those are also mentioned in the action guidelines. So those are the successor to the impact guidelines. So lots of information. I'm happy to take questions.
Go ahead first.
Yeah, this is Dave O'Brien. I thought Steve well outlined the heterogeneity of a lot of literature there and different criteria. And I would tend to agree that of those that get greater than 50% relief compared to those that get 75% relief and go into a more definitive procedure, there may not be much difference in the outcomes from some of the studies I've read. I guess one concern I had is, you know, if we only do one block and it's a false positive, and then that patient gets put into a treatment program and may have basically repeated procedures for a misdiagnosis for some period of time, you know, that's obviously not ideal or cost effective. And Steve can correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought he was involved with a study looking at percent success RFA, and going from one block to two blocks was almost, 39%, I think it was up to 60-some percent with two block success rate. And it was a small study compared to no blocks. It was only like a third of patients got better. So, you know, NASS has looked at this, SIS and other organizations, and some of their guidelines do recommend dual blocks for those purposes to minimize proceeding with treatments on patients that actually don't have the problem. The other kind of thing that is a little bit of a mess with this issue is a lot of the studies were obviously based on intra-articular blocks in response to that, whereas for RFA, we're not doing an intra-articular procedure. And that's where, you know, NASS guidelines are recommending two positive blocks for lateral branch blocks and L5 dorsoramus block as a prognostic evaluation to help diagnose or predict what people will respond to RFA of the sacroiliac joint. So I think in a coverage policy, I think there's one thing to look at an interarticular block if somebody's thinking about a fusion and getting a positive response, but I think it's I personally think, based on some literature and the significance of undergoing SI joint fusion, that a two-block protocol is appropriate. And I'm not sure why we wouldn't do the same thing as once they get diagnosed with this and they undergo RFA, especially if they're younger, they may be getting repeat procedures for numerous years. And I think having a confirmatory block to at least isolate that patient population that will respond appropriately, a reasonable thing to consider incorporating.
Thank you. Very, very interesting. So I think I know a lot about this. I've spoken with almost all of the directors of these organizations. I speak to Milan, who's, you know, now the editor of the SIS's new guidelines and the editor-in-chief of their journals. And I had been the chair of both the lumbar and the cervical facet guidelines committee. So the SIS guidelines about two blocks, they came out in the mid-1990s. So we lived in a different world. Back then, people were getting, you know, spine fusions very easy, and, you know, they were getting put on very high and aggressive doses of opioids. That was also before IMPACT said that 30% is, you know, clinically meaningful. And across the globe, like I said, not just the FDA, but the European Medicines Agency basically uses the same thing. 50% is a substantial responder, 30%. But the best data that we have on, clearly that's the rationale for two blocks, is that it reduces the false positive rate. But the other thing is the more blocks you do, and this is inevitable, right, it increases the false negative rate. And the only data that we have on this is you know, Rick Derby's data, who's from the SIS. And so he found that there was a 40%, 47% false negative rate. So people who had, like I say, if you have a negative block, then you get the block repeated, 47% of them are positive, and then 74% of those, then out of the people who underwent radiofrequency, so there were 8 of them, 6 of them had a positive outcome. So he concluded 47% false negative rate. So that's the problem. And clearly at the current reimbursement rates, you know, our, that 2010 study by us that we, you know, that you just quoted, you know, zero block is the most cost effective. So the Journal of Anesthesiology, for a while, that was the most publicized article, right? They had a big, huge, you know, webinar. That was their first webinar. So it was run by Jim Rathmel and Jan Van Zundert and Martin Van Cleef, who just passed away 3 weeks ago, who has a PhD in radio frequency ablation. And they said, you know, one block seems to make sense. The other problem with doing, you know, two blocks is there are two other things. So all of the studies for surgery, they do one block. So that's an inconsistency that really has to kind of be addressed. And if you're looking at spine fusion surgery, most studies don't do any blocks, right? They don't do discography. And the other thing is a really high percentage, and, you know, you make a comment about SIS. So DJ Kennedy now, I think, is the president of SIS, and he'll be the president of AUPM&R. And he said, you know, when he does two blocks, when he's forced to do blocks, he goes, about 90% of the people have a positive response to a second block. And it might be that, you know, these people aren't blinded. So, you know, people don't want to come back for a second block, especially if you work and you have to bring an escort. So you basically say, I'm sorry, you have to do a second block. I know you want this treatment. Your insurance company covers it. So for whatever reason it is, you know, you don't really have two blocks. So you're subjecting people to additional costs, additional risks. And like I said, it doesn't really seem to have a big difference, and you have to weigh the costs of you know, access to care. So more blocks will decrease the false positive rate, but absolutely you will start to have false negative rates. You'll have people who kind of drop out, and it's not cost effective. You know, CMS, all the people can make it cost effective by either reducing the amount that we get reimbursed for the diagnostic blocks themselves, or just increasing the cost of radiofrequency ablation, then it would become more cost-effective. So, like I say, you're going to decrease the number of people overall who have a successful procedure. You're going to increase the costs. That's what ends up happening with multiple blocks. And like I said, that's what our study clearly showed for lumbar percent, and that's what Nick Bogduk even, you know, who was the initial advocate for two blocks. He even wrote like a big editorial. He says the travesty of cost effectiveness is that in the United States, you know, it's not cost effective. And the problem with, you know, having these false negative blocks is that what do you do with these people? Then they end up getting surgery, or they get put on opioids because there's nothing else that's really a great treatment. So I think, like I said, we should be really prioritizing access to care.
Hey, just a quick question, Ms. Chirag, again. So, the discography question aside, because that goes down a different road for fusions, right, in terms of why you're doing a surgery if you're going down that road. And I'm not sure the utility of discography, but the study where the false negative rate goes up with two blocks, how many patients were included in that study?
So they're Rick Derby's study. So it was either, you know, it's very hard to interpret his things. I mean, I can, it's,
oh, right? It was a very low number thing.
I think that's what, that, Yeah, that's why I'm asking the question, is that, I mean, we're extrapolating from one study, and if the numbers aren't great, can we truly say, you know, based off one study that, you know, okay, it's going to increase the false negative rate?
But we don't have, there are no other studies. So that's kind of the problem if you're looking at false negative. And, yes, it's very hard also to extrapolate for lumbar facet blocks to something else. So retrospective study, 229 patients who underwent medial branch blocks. But, again, not all negative blocks had a second block, but out of those who did, 47% with the people with a negative block had a positive block. And then out of the people who with a second positive block who underwent radiofrequency, 75% had a positive outcome. So, you know, I think it's kind of problematic that there are major operations, including SI joint fusion, where they use a block. A lot of them use 5 cc's, one single block. They had 50% pain relief, and then they end up getting a fusion. And that we're trying to say, well, you know, you're going to have radiofrequency procedure, which there's multiple studies that show efficacy. Efficacy and effectiveness, and we're requiring, kind of a higher threshold for them to undergo a less invasive procedure. So I mean, at least there's no doubt that there's inconsistency.
Yeah, right. I see your point. I would just say that I wouldn't. You could ask the question: Is the one block before an SI joint fusion sufficient, and is that an appropriate thing? And then you appropriately brought up the fact that many of those SI joint fusion trials are industry sponsored, right? And many of the people involved in those trials have consulting agreements, and so there's an inherent conflict that is always going to be there with some of that data as well.
This is Doug Beal. I just have a quick comment. So some additional literature here, and generally I agree with what Steve said about one block and the threshold, but you know, it ranges all the way from Joe Forden's, you know, early mid-90s study with 50% relief all the way to Paul Dreyfus' study shortly after that with 90% as a threshold. And then there's, you know, 70-75% by Broadhurst and May, and Curtis Slipman had a 80% threshold. But general, and Laszlo's paper thrown in there as well, but all of this kind of agrees with, you know, one block and, you know, somewhere in the range of 50-75% is adequate. And as I don't want to belabor it, and maybe less is appropriate.
And like I said, the industry guidelines, the impact guidelines, would say 30% is clinically meaningful. I just have to emphasize that this is really followed across the entire, not just the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, but this is followed by, like I said, all over Europe.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that.
I'm not a pain management or anesthesia, so excuse me if I'm not understanding something that's basic to your practice. But I'm hearing the interarticular blocks would let you know if the patient was going to respond therapeutically or potentially if they would benefit from fusion, but not necessarily predictive of their response to RFA, where the lateral branches might be more predictive. So how do you select which patients would receive therapeutic treatment versus an RFA, and should they be getting different blocks for different assessments?
So this is a great, great question. It's very hard, but if you look at a lot of the studies, what they did was they did screening blocks, and they did, when you do an intra-articular block, a lot of it goes extra-articular because the joint capacity is probably a little bit more than 2 cc's. So, there are studies, I can go over every single one of these. I always lecture on this topic, but there's probably greater evidence for, the best studies are Mayo Clinic preceding study. Patients were randomized. They didn't know what they got. But basically, intra and extra articular injections, the positive rate of a block is almost the same. So young people are more likely to have extra-articular sacroiliac joint pain. So they, you know, it's from like ligamentous injury, things like that. Whereas older people with bilateral symptoms, they might have less tenderness because it's not their ligament, it's deeper. You know, bilateral symptoms, they're more likely to have intra-articular. So the indications for fusion in their studies, and I haven't read all of their studies, but generally is instability or like severe degenerative joint disease. Whereas the indications for, you know, for radiofrequency is it should be extra-articular, right? Because those lateral branches innervate the ligament. So what people usually do is they do a block. It might be intra-articular. It could be extra-articular, but intra-articular blocks often go into the ligament. They're usually just not confined to the joint space. So they go out into the ligaments. And then a lot of the studies, and these were sponsored by, you know, Avanos, which makes cooled radiofrequency. So there's three of the studies. Then they require a positive lateral branch block. You can't do a lateral branch block as a diagnostic tool, right? Because those lateral branches don't innervate the joint capsule, and they may or may not, they certainly don't innervate all of the bone. But so those are purely prognostic blocks. So it is possible that that people end up getting a screening injection, and then if that's positive and you want to do radiofrequency ablation, don't make them do another screening injection. A lateral branch block might make sense. So that's prognostic, right? We're blocking these nerves with low volumes. This is going to tell us what type of pain relief they're going to get if we do radiofrequency of these nerves.
So
in other words, they're different different purposes.
So intra-articular block, to add on to what Steve said, helps to evaluate for intra-articular pain, and that's why a lot of the guidelines recommend injecting, you know, not much more than 2 cc's from a diagnostic standpoint, and if they get good relief with that, and you know, whether it's one block or two, then perhaps a fusion would be a benefit, unless they can get a prolonged therapeutic improvement from a steroid injection, like those with the spondyloarthropathies. But if they don't respond to an intra-articular block, but they still have this SI joint kind of picture on their exam and a lot of buttock pain, then perhaps the lateral branch blocks from a diagnostic standpoint or prognostic standpoint to evaluate whether they respond to RFA would be the appropriate next step to consider. I still, you know, the percent pain relief, whether it's 50 or 75, is one thing. I still think if we can get, if six, and I don't think we're supposed to be looking at cost when we're deciding what appropriate coverage policy is, but if you do an extra block that they positively respond to, and 65% success rate with RFA on those people compared to like 40% if they only get one block, yeah, that's 25% difference. Is it? And these people will often come back for repeat procedures. So of those extra 25% that are coming back that really aren't getting good relief, you know, I mean, that's just the way I'm thinking about it. That's why I kind of lean towards the dual block. As far as the percent pain relief, I think there's more gray there about what the appropriate cutoff is. But I'm not sure. I have a hard time understanding the cost effectiveness of just one block or going straight to RFA on something that's not been clearly diagnosed.
Yeah, so that's a 2010 paper. So obviously the you know, the zero block. So in the two block group, you know, there you're paying for radio frequency, you're paying for two blocks. So there's definitely going to be less people who benefit. Right, because you're going to every block that you do, there's a potential for false negatives. So less people benefit, but the overall costs, because of the ratio of cost, the payment ratio between radio frequency and blocks. So not only the cost per successful treatment, which is going to be much higher, but the overall costs are higher, and that's not even including, you know, that people have to miss work and an escort has to come in for, you know, for these blocks. Like you say, but that's not the case in every single country, right? Because if there's countries where the cost of radiofrequency is 5 times more than the cost of blocks, then it's cost effective to do, you know, more than one block, because you want to prevent radio frequency. That's why discography is always cost effective. And the last point is the studies for SI joint fusion are really flawed. So they did one block, they had 50% pain relief, and most of them used, a lot of them used 5 cc's. So 5 cc blocks, you're either, maybe the capsule is rupturing or it's diffusing all out into the ligament. Like, we don't know why they're getting pain relief. So those studies are terribly flawed.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that at all. But getting back to our project, and the CMS staff can correct me if I'm wrong, we're not a, like you mentioned, if RFA costs,
right,
we're not supposed to be addressing costs. And so if we're saying RFA is a very expensive procedure, then we should do 2 blocks to really confirm the diagnosis, no matter what the RFA costs in the United States and countries. Why, if we want to get an accurate diagnosis, then why would we not do 2 blocks if we would do it if the treatment was going to be expensive?
I
think we've got more to discuss on this topic, and I think it's going to overlap with question number 8. But to ensure that Dr. Varnese has ample time to answer his questions, I do want to get those 2 questions done, and then we can return to this as we go through question number 8, and then additionally at the end, if needed. So I don't want to stop the important conversation, but I do want to make sure we get Dr. Varnese's expertise in. So if I can jump ahead to question 9.
Hi. Dr. Abby Varnese. So my question, is there literature to support a role for cryoanalgesia? In the stack of the literature that we received, there wasn't an article that specifically talked about cryoanalgesia. I asked for an article for what I should base my opinion off of. I was sent an article called Novel Non-Opiate Regional Analgesic Cryoanalgesia Percutaneous Peripheral Nerve Stimulation and Liposomal Local Anesthetic, and that article really only discussed what cryoanalgesia is and its role really in addressing peripheral nerves. There isn't really an application for addressing joint pain, and that's the topic we're talking about. To answer the question, there isn't any literature that I received that says that cryoanalgesia is appropriate for sacroiliac joint pain, whether that's acute or chronic.
Thank you. We have not identified literature either, but there is some use of it, so that's where we want to know what the evidence is. So I appreciate that.
Sure, my experience with the cryoanalgesia is fairly recent, and really specifically using it to address, right now we're exploring chronic shoulder pain and for lateral femoral cutaneous neuralgia, and then I know anesthesia uses it often for intercostal addressing intercostal nerve pain pre and post-operatively prior to, thoracic cavity-type procedures.
Any other comments on cryoanalgesia? So if we can jump all the way ahead to question 15.
Yeah, I appreciate that. So my question there is there evidence to support the administration of the sacroiliac joint injections at the same time as injections in other locations, such as epidural and SI joint injections in the same session? So that's an interesting question. When I looked at the literature, really the only thing that was consistent throughout was addressing the lateral branches and then the L5 dorsal ramus when doing blocks of radio frequency ablation to address sacroiliac joint pain. When you look at the physical exam literature that was provided to us and the requirements of, or the, how should I say it, the significant increase in sensitivity and specificity when you have three positive provocative maneuvers for SI joint pain. And I think it would be really difficult if you're trying to make an appropriate diagnosis to address a different structure at the same time that you're doing an SI joint injection because it would skew your outcomes. I mean, if you think that when you look at, again, there's an article in the physical therapy literature that was provided to us that talks about the variety of different things that can cause low back pain. Not any particular one requires the number of provocative maneuvers that sacroiliac joint pain off that that sacroiliac joint pain needs really to give yourself confidence to address that. Obviously, if you think that a patient had a radiculopathy, rather than just subjective findings reported by the patient, if you obviously see weakness in a myotome, in a consistent nerve distribution, all lots of reflex, then you're probably not going to address the SI joint. You're probably going to move towards getting imaging and looking for some type of evidence that would support your clinical diagnosis. If you take an excellent history and do an appropriate physical exam, I think based on the literature, you're going to do only one intervention for one structure to start addressing the patient's pain problems.
You know, and a lot of these studies, they did intra-articular injections, and they did, kind of small volume. So a lot of people call it sacroiliac complex pain, right, because it can be from ligaments. So it's hard to imagine that, you know, provocative maneuvers would, be positive, equally positive when you have ligamentous pain, you know, and there's a lot of studies that show that the presentation is different. So from Japan, for like upper joint, lower joint, the ventral part of the joint, the ligament, capsular tears, you know, synovitis, just bone pathology with the osteophytes. And I would say that our study from 2022 found that there was no correlation whatsoever with SI joint outcomes, based on a positive Gensler's and Faber or Patrick's test. So I think that there's some other literature in the physical therapy. Mark Laslett was traditionally one of the leaders in this, and they said that if the pain, they I think term it like a centralization versus lateral pain. So it's kind of, I like that Fortin finger test. If people say that this is the most prominent part of their pain, if it's tender over there, and it's near the PSIS, that there's a really good chance that they have SI joint pain. And again, the gold standard is really these diagnostic blocks. And a lot of those studies, and they're not all positive, where provocative tests predict response to blocks, but they are for low-volume intra-articular injections. And again, radio frequency, at least, you're not, those are targeting the ligaments.
I like that. So specifically regarding question 15, I don't see any logic in doing multiple injections in multiple areas of the spine on the same day on that patient. Epidural injections, facet injections, and SI injections diagnostically and therapeutically are for different indications and reasons. If you did an epidural injection at the same time you did an SI injection, especially using anesthetic, I don't know what, it doesn't tell you anything. So you lose all your diagnostic information. And what we're talking about is primarily diagnostic injections, these SI joint injections or lateral branch blocks. So I don't see any logic in allowing multiple spinal injections to be done on the same patient in the same day for this condition. It doesn't seem to make any logical sense, and you'd lose all your diagnostic abilities, and you don't really know what you're treating.
That said perfectly. I would add this one caveat, you know, because SI joint pain frequently co-occurs with greater trochanteric pain syndrome. If someone's coming, if it's very difficult for them to travel, they're disabled, if they're coming from very long periods of time, and I really feel it's important for them not to have to take another flight to come back for two separate injections, and I feel that it's medically necessary, then I do those procedures. And if I do one with local anesthetic, and I might do the trochanteric bursar injection just with steroid, so it does not lose the diagnostic validity.
So if I can also comment there, just an extension to your point, Dr. Cohen, you know, piriformis myalgia, not piriformis syndrome, the piriformis muscle attached to the front of the sacrum to the greater trochanter, a lot of patients present with sitting intolerance, which is classic for SI joint pain. Patients can present with what seem to be radicular symptoms, though it may be more of a spasm of the piriformis muscle or dysfunction of the SI joint causing piriformis muscle spasm and presenting as a sciatica. I think that is the only time that I do a second structure, because it's just off the inferior pole of the SI joint. So I would do an SI joint injection, and then the piriformis muscle trigger point injection, and then I send them to therapy to address it, assuming they're not presenting with any other physical exam findings suggesting a true radic.
But yeah. I would play devil's advocate, and if you think they have piriformis syndrome causing radicular pain, then why not just do a piriformis block? And because, again, you just diagnostic, well, you don't know what's causing their problem. And I'm not sure if there's what the literature shows about SI problems causing piriformis problems and piriformis syndrome.
Can I just clarify who the last person to speak is on the piriformis trigger point? I just didn't catch who was speaking.
That was me, Dr. Varghese.
Thank you.
And this is Dr. O'Brien. With my comments regarding, I still don't understand the logic. I think if you think the piriformis muscle is the problem, then do a piriformis block. I think if you block multiple areas around the hip or SI joint, then you're not going to get, I don't think you know what you're treating. I mean, a trochanteric bursitis is easy to diagnose. And those rare occasions where somebody just put steroid, like Steve said, in the bursa, if the patient has to fly to see him for this, that's understandable. But that's, you know, 1% of the patients we're talking about. I mean, these people are coming in with back pain. There's a lot of lumbar structures that refer into the buttock. And we're doing the blocks to diagnose where the pain is coming from to then determine whether it would be appropriate for another type of treatment. Or hopefully they have a therapeutic benefit, but I just don't see the logic in doing facet blocks, epidurals, and SI joints, and I've seen this out in the community, and there were hip injections, and they all use anesthetic and steroids in each of these areas, so I don't know what's being treated, and I'm not sure it makes sense. You know, I think there should be a good medical necessity for performing a procedure. And then to rule in or rule out something in these situations that we're primarily doing it to help diagnose their condition.
Thank you. I think that was a great discussion. And if there's no further comments on that question, I'd like to move us back to question number 8.
Okay, Doug Beal here. I'm going to address this is a multiple series of corollary questions to question number 8. So the assessment of the clinical literature to conclude the role of RF in the management of SI joint dysfunction. So there's ample clinical literature in this area. This includes six level one manuscripts and five sham-controlled RCTs, two by Nilesh Patel, Dr. Cohen, who's on, Zing, Van Tilborg, and Mehta. And this first started by Ferrante in the early 2000s for introducing the bipolar technique along to create a strip lesion just medial to the SI joint at 1 centimeter intervals. And this was followed shortly after that by monopolar technique to target the lateral branches of the primary dorsal rami. And this was done in several studies, which reported greater than 60% pain relief for 6 months or more. And in addition to the unipolar, the bipolar, there has been other techniques that have been used. There have been to medially ablate the lateral branch lesions, including strip lesions, quadrupolar ablation, and then heated and cooled RF, which are essentially the same thing with a different technique. So out of the highest quality data, the six level one manuscripts, the first two sham trials that were published showed a comparison between group comparison for those treated with RFA were four times more likely to achieve a 50% or greater pain reduction. The most recent sham-controlled trial showed relief of pain in both groups, and one trial had a statistically significant relief of pain for the group treated with strip lesioning, so this is a slightly different technique. Five of the six level one trials showed statistically significantly better outcomes as compared with either non-surgical management or sham treatment. And then in addition to these level one trials, there are several meta-analyses that have supported RFA of the SI joints for patients treated with RFA neurotomy that had statistically significantly greater improvement in pain and function, also quality of life scores as compared with controls. Additional subgroup analysis achieved the same thing, and there is a book chapter that goes through interventional pain medicine evidence and recommended that SI joint pain should start with conservative treatment followed by intra-articular injection followed by RF, and that's also supported in some additional studies that I'll talk about in just a second. So in summary, there are multiple different RFA techniques that may be used in managing symptoms from SI joint dysfunction. The highest quality of evidence, level evidence, as I mentioned, has six level one manuscripts, and all but one showed statistically significantly better outcomes as compared with non-surgical management or sham. The meta-analysis have also supported the treatment of the SI joint with RFA, showing significantly better pain and functional improvements than those who were not treated with RFA. So I'll move on to the first additional question here. Does the literature support cooled versus heated RF? And I want to clarify here that these are both techniques using heat. The cooling of the tip is designed to reduce charring and expand the ablation zone in terms of, and all the way out to about 600 cubic millimeters. And so this is just a different technique, both using heat. And whenever we say cool RF, that's what we mean. But they both use heat for radiofrequency ablation. So Leo Caprell showed in his retrospective review of 27 patients with pain who underwent RFA, the lateral branch nerves of the sacrum had significant improvements in pain and function that was durable to at least 4 months. And then a later study, a randomized control trial by our Dr. Cohen compared cool RF to placebo and found significant improvements in pain and function from the patient's baseline status and greater global perception of effect. Carmen studied 15 patients with chronic SI joint pain and found a median pain score reduction of 8 to a 3 at 6 months, and ODI decreased from 36 to 14 at the same time. Nilesh Patel showed in the randomized control trial that lateral branch RFA was significantly better in terms of pain, function, and quality of life to sham treatment. And then there's a negative one, the only negative trial was one by 2016 by Van Tilburg that failed to show significantly improved pain and RFA over sham, but this study was kind of criticized due to the statement in the trial itself for the diagnosis of SI pain may have included patients without SI pain. That's just a statement the authors included in their own trial. So it's worthy of mention. And then after this, strip lesioning shows in with some of the longer RF ablation devices concluded that there was significant reduction in pain over a 3 month time period as compared with Celebrex, as I mentioned previously. And then an additional large randomized controlled trial comparing Cool RF to standard medical management in 210 patients showed a 50% more reduction in back pain with following SI joint injection selection. These patients were selected specifically with an SI joint injection, had an average of 10 years, and this is unpublished data, so I'm just with this now. Just got the early release of 3 months. Data included statistically significant reduction in pain and improvement in function, quality of life, disability, and global perception of change. So in summary for this, there's ample literature support for Cool RFA, including case reports, case series, 2 meta-analyses, 3 systemic reviews, 4 blinded sham controlled trials, and a large multi-center trial. So in addition to this high-quality data, there's also 6 level 3 and 4 manuscripts and additional 3 technology contributions to the literature. So in summary, there's strong support for both heated and cooled RFA for the treating the SI joint dysfunction pain. So a natural extension of that is the next question, is one superior to the other? And so there are multiple RCTs, including SAM controlled trials that we just mentioned, comparing SI joint RF to standard medical management, but there is only one level 2 trial that compared thermal and cooled RF. And so this trial failed to show any difference between cooled RF and thermal RF. So in summary of this, there's multiple RCTs, including sham-controlled trials, large trials comparing RFA to non-surgical management or standard medical management, and all showing statistically significant benefit between group comparisons of SI joint RFA over non-surgical management, regardless of whether the traditional RFA or cooled techniques were used. I'm just going to go ahead and go through these last few. Can all branches be reached? As was indicated previously, the answer to that is no. Solonen had a great anatomic description that says the dorsal innervation comes from the lumbosacral trunk, superior gluteal nerve, and the dorsal rami of S1 and S2. And then the anterior joint is innervated by the ventral rami of L5 and S2. So that's the difference between the dorsal and ventral rami, and the dorsal rami are reached, the lateral branches, and the ventrals are not. So there are some reports saying that the innervation from the noxious stimuli are largely present in the dorsal portion. And most recent studies showed that although most of the innervation is from the posterior portion of the joint, there's still some contribution of the anterior portion of the joint by L4, L5, and S1. So to summarize this, most but not all nerves that are transmitting the noxious stimuli can be reached by the dorsal treatment methods. On to the next one, how long should treatment be considered before it is successful? So the best quality data measurements, as we've discussed, range between 6 months and 1 year, and there is a significant improvement measured out to at least 6 months in a number of these. When SI joint, Vanna Close had a great paper comparing SI joint to non-surgical management in SI joint fusion. It showed a response of 6 months for the RFA. Moving on to kind of quality adjusted life years, Blissett had a paper, and this is based on NICE data that says SI joint injections in terms of qualities are for RF or no RF is about the same as RFA only, and then RFA following physical examination or other conservative measures are about the same and slightly lower qualities than SI joint fusion. So, and also this is based on cost effectiveness at 7.9 months. So summary of this, based on the current literature and what's clinically sustainable and pragmatic and adequate length of time for RFA or the procedure to be effective in terms of duration is 6 months. And that's it.
Just a little, right? It's a lot of questions. And we'll open that for additional discussion.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good summary. Here's how I think of it. So the lateral branches converge onto the foramen, right, the sacral foramen. And it's very variable. They vary in terms of number and location. So there could be one, there could be four. So even if you were to do stimulation, sensory stimulation, and you got amazing stimulation and you were positive you were there, you could still miss 75% of the nerves. So you need to have some kind of lesioning strategy that captures the nerves. The advantage of cooled radio frequency is that the lesion is much, much larger, and it's also greater depth. So the total area lesioned is really eight times. So, you know, for something where you have a lot of variability in the number of nerves, the location of nerves, like I say, you have to have kind of a very aggressive lesioning strategy. And you know, cooled RF is, you know, kind of fits that. So that there's lots of studies, and that if you strategically place these electrodes, you can kind of capture the nerves. The lateral branches go, like I say, run at different depths. So in Paul Dreyfus's study, you know, he had found when he was doing lateral branch blocks that you have to do them at different depths. So that's kind of another advantage, that you have, like I say, deeper lesions. So I think it makes a lot of conceptual sense to, you know, why cooled radio frequency, you know, would be effective. We had done a study, it's old, it's over 10 years old, and we looked at outcome predictors for lateral branch. There weren't a huge number of patients. I think there were a little bit less than 80. And there was a trend for, you know, cooled radio frequency to do a little bit better than conventional radio frequency. So if there were more patients, and of course, you know, if you're really comparing two different techniques, so if you need 299 patients to show a difference between, you know, radio frequency and a sham radio frequency, if you're comparing two different radio frequency techniques, so it becomes a comparative effectiveness study, you know, you need exponentially more patients than that. You know, you might need 800 or 900. So I think that, you know, it's very hard to show superiority comparing two different techniques in a clinical trial, because they're all very, very underpowered.
Yeah, so, Steve, this is Doug Beal again. Just to comment that I agree with that exactly. I think it's a trend. It takes a very large number, a very high end. The only one that showed a comparison between the techniques is that level two Xielong Qi article that I quoted, and that had, you know, that had 195 patients. So, I mean, this is very difficult to show anything more than a trend, and that's what Cool RF does. It shows a trend toward better results, but to show significance would require a mammoth size trial.
And to summarize, correct me if I'm wrong, but a variety of these techniques showed benefit.
Yeah, they basically all showed benefit, you know, whether it be traditional heated, cooled, strip lesion, quadrupolar lesion, they all showed pretty consistent benefits.
Yeah, I think it's important for any coverage policy to make it clear, because I think coders and insurance company nurses and so forth get confused when they see cooled RF thinking it's cryoablation, and it's not. So that
That's why I tried to call that out, because it's, you know, it's still heat. It's just cool at the tip for a wider range of ablation. So that's right. All of this cool RF is still heat treatment, not cryo.
Thank you for making that clear. Are there any other comments for question 8? Then we'll jump ahead to question 10, since we already did 9. And Dr. Padia? Dr. Padia, are you on the line? Dr. Padia?
It looks like she lost connection. Do you want me to try recalling her?
Yes, please. While we do that, we'll move ahead to question 11.
Hey, this is Chirag. I wasn't sure. I fell off for some reason. I just got back on.
Oh, great. Well, perfect. Let's go back to question 10.
Should diagnostic injections be required before fusion? If so, one or two. I sent this out to everybody. I found a few articles that either talked about injections or directly addressed the question, I think, as best you can. I'll reference Cohen's point earlier that a lot of the surgical trials, involved one, and again, the caveats around the conflict of interest, I won't belabor that. I do think that there have been some recommendations for two diagnostic injections, but as I was trying to look through the data, there was one study by Dave Pauly, where they looked, it was a subset other studies, where they looked at whether SI joint block would predict. Now, the threshold was that they needed 50% threshold before they got to an SI joint fusion. The degree of pain improvement after that, it didn't make any difference in terms of the outcome after that, but they did have that threshold. Beyond that, I didn't find really any great studies that directly answered this specific question as it pertains to SI joint fusion related to a block that distinctly showed, okay, we're going to do these blocks and then look at the outcome and does one or two make a difference.
Evidence. What do you do in practice when you don't have evidence to guide it?
Yeah. So clinically, two is generally what. In terms of what I tend to focus on and what I've seen most folks require, or frankly what many of the payers would require as well. Having done this literature review, I'm not sure that can be founded with robust data, but yeah, too.
Yeah, Dave O'Brien, the trouble is that there is pretty much, this is all industry studies, I believe. And I think it gets back to when you're doing a definitive procedure like a fusion, which may or may not be that reversible, just to maximize the accuracy of the diagnosis. That's why I know the North American Spine Society and some others recommended two blocks to help confirm and rule out any false positives before proceeding with.
So to throw a different opinion out there, this is Doug Beal. I do one block, and that's it. And typically the patients that I treat, we take them all the way from SI pain. In conservative treatment, we do injections followed by RFA, followed by fusion in that order almost always. And by the time they get down to the permanent changes of a fusion, we know it's not really about whether the pain is coming from the SI joint or not, because it's been effective at the previous treatment. It's just ineffective in regards to duration of effect.
Yeah. So, David, you're saying you do a block, and then you do have them get an RFA before you go on to a fusion, right?
That's not Dave. That's Doug Beal.
Oh, sorry, Doug.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, I mean, I say it's almost always in that order. Sometimes we don't do an RFA if we're pretty sure that it's in that location and go ahead with the fusion. But our vast majority of our typical patient population is we go from injections to RFA to fusion, and we use the typical duration of pain relief by injection and RFA. And if it's not 6 months to a year more, then we go on to the next step. And when, and by the time we get to the latter part of the treatment algorithm, you know, you're pretty darn sure somebody's had, you know, a physical exam test, they've had injections, they've had RFA, and that's just they have failed in terms of duration of relief, not response.
Yeah, see that, and to me that makes sense. You know, you're, the question around false positives, you're basically trying to reduce that possibility, right, by putting them through all of this stuff. So that,
yeah,
I think correlates with essentially, you know, what I, what I'm seeing generally out there.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, I support one block, because, you know, if you do perform like this, from least invasive to most invasive, using the inverse pyramid of stomatos, you're pretty sure by that time, and I don't really want to be required to have another block, and some that we've already done lots of stuff on already, typically.
Yeah, so you could, the question could be modified, right? Diagnostic injections be required. So that'd be one, question one. And again, I can't say that there's data that says that, that the answer to that is yes or no. I think it'll just be expertise and general practice. And then this idea of if it's one or two, I think it depends to your point about how do you go about thinking about it. If you've got a robust algorithm and the patients are kind of getting funneled through, then the intent of having two is already being addressed. For those who don't have such an intense algorithm, you know, perhaps two is a better way to go. But.
Yeah, I mean, I would just say this, you know, that the stringency of selection criteria should depend on kind of the invasiveness and the cost and the risks of the procedure. So if you have a risky, expensive procedure like a fusion, then you need to have selection criteria that has very high positive predictive value and specificity. So under these circumstances, it could be justifiable to do two blocks, and those blocks should probably not be exactly with the same local anesthetic, because you're likely to get the same results. Although, you know, the whole paradigm of a block with lidocaine and a block with bupivacaine is flawed. So even the SIF people say that you only have 54% sensitivity when you do it that way. So there's false negatives. But that, like I say, that's it becomes justifiable when you have to really require, you know, stringent selection criteria if you have a very invasive definitive procedure. And that's why I would say that radio, it should not be that way for radio frequency. You know, radio frequency is very similar to lateral branch blocks, you know, in terms of like serious complication rates, and even costs are not that much different. Over.
Yeah, so to go back to routine clinical practice, I think most people have the algorithm of going from less invasive to more invasive, and also maybe more definitive. But so to require a routine clinical practice of two blocks to me doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. I mean, for the reasons that have been described previously by Steve and the answers on the pre-procedure block magnitude of relief. So I really think just going through clinical practice, just one block, and to make something that does not really adhere to routine clinical practice, a requirement of two blocks, maybe if that's historic, including all injections, all RF, I mean, that could be feasible. But two blocks, just pulling that out of the clear blue sky, it's not pragmatic, nor is it helpful to me.
Thank you for the interesting discussion and thorough discussion on it's always difficult in the areas that lack evidence, so we appreciate your expertise. And Peter, did Dr. Goller send you an answer for question number 11?
Yes, I have it for 11 and her, and also the third question as well that she was assigned.
Great. So if we can go to question 11.
Yes. Question 11 is, what does the evidence say in terms of the number of SI injections that are reasonable within 6 months and 12 months and time between injections? And then the third part is about the number of RFAs in 12 months and the minimum time between treatments. She states there's really a lack of very strong evidence in the literature to support the exact frequency or timing of the SI joint intra-articular injections at, you know, totals for at 6 to 12 months. But using the criteria that she was able to find within the literature, as well as other criteria that are used for similar type of injections, such as ESIs, her suggestion is there should be no more than two of these injections per six-month period and no more than four in a 12-month period. And to ensure adequacy from relief from these injections, she believes you must demonstrate at least a 50% relief that lasts a minimum of 8 to 12 weeks before repeating the injections. And as far as the radio, and I don't know if anybody wants to state anything there before I move on to her answer on the RF.
Yeah, this is Dave O'Brien. I think there's two types of injections. Sometimes we're doing it to diagnose and may just use anesthetic, and other times we're trying to do a therapeutic. So, for therapeutic, obviously I think most of us would agree that you need a certain percent of pain improvement for a certain amount of months to justify repeat in the future, because if it doesn't last long, after one or two tries, you're kind of spinning our wheels. But from a diagnostic standpoint, if, say, somebody did a block and they had maybe an equivocal response or maybe a positive response, but their pain came back quickly and they have bad arthritis and you're thinking about doing a fusion, you know, there's no reason not to repeat it, you know, a couple weeks later to confirm the diagnosis if that's what the criteria the doctors want or the payers want. So for diagnostic block, I think waiting, you know, 2 weeks, I mean, there's really not a great reason to wait 2 weeks, but just to be consistent with other policies is reasonable. And now, and I know they have that, I think it's the KX modifier for diagnostic blocks for facet that's added onto the codes to differentiate that from a therapeutic injection. So that may be something for you to consider for SI blocks too, for to differentiate, you know, diagnostic intra-articular block from somebody that's getting a therapeutic injection that should have prolonged improvement in their condition. So I just bring that out there as a point that for diagnostic blocks, there's probably not a reason not to repeat a second block rather quickly, but I would agree that for therapeutic injections, we obviously want to see a more durable, longer-term improvement in pain and function than just a week or two.
Fair enough. Anybody else have any comments before moving to RFs?
I also would say for I didn't see anything here about documentation requirements, but for diagnostic blocks, I think the pre and post pain scores of the day of the procedure would be worth considering for a documentation requirement for these procedures. For repeat therapeutic injections, you know, obviously I think the response from a previous injection, percent improvement and duration of improvement, whether it's, you know, 3 months or 6 months or 7 months, to justify repeat therapeutic procedures is important, as we already have in many coverage policies.
Nope, understood. For radio frequency ablations, again, same thing with the data, but what data there is, she supports two injections per 12-month period or one every 6 months.
I mean, again, the literature's lacking for this, but for facet procedures, they generally require greater than 50% relief for at least 6 months, and I think that would be a reasonable approach for SI joint RF procedures and the need to repeat them to document if those people fit that scenario. Obviously, if they only have a month or two of improvement, I'm not sure it's worth I personally don't think it's worth repeating the procedures if they don't get long-term efficacy of some sort.
Thank you. That is all I have for that question.
Thank you very much. And so we'll move to question 12. And this question is for Dr. Cohen and Brian Jacobs.
Steve, I'll go first if that's okay.
Yeah.
So, does the literature support any indications that SI joint injections need to be performed under sedation or anesthesia? And how about for RF? So guiding language regarding sedation for these procedures is available from the American Society of Anesthesiologists Pain Medicine Committee, who suggests sedation is usually unnecessary for procedures like sacroiliac joint injections. As it relates to the diagnostic use of sacroiliac joint injections, Cohen and colleagues in 2014 concluded the use of sedation during diagnostic procedures of the sacroiliac joint may increase the rate of false positive blocks. Although similar consensus guidelines for sacroiliac joint injections are not yet published, a multi-society working group addressing diagnostic prognostic lumbar facet injections also does not recommend routine administration of sedation for these procedures in the absence of reasonable indications. Again, if we're going to extrapolate from practices in the lumbar spine, the ACIP guidelines from 2020 for facet joint interventions in low back pain have level 2 evidence with moderate strength to avoid opioid analgesics during diagnostic facet injection, and level 2 evidence with moderate strength that moderate sedation may be utilized for patient comfort to control anxiety for therapeutic facet injections. Moving on to RF, while there's no direct evidence to attest to the utility of patient sedation during SI ablation, again, the American Society of Anesthesiologists Pain Medicine Committee suggests factors such as anxiety or comorbid medical conditions may require moderate sedation or utilization of the anesthesia care team during procedures which require the patient to remain still for prolonged periods of time, such as with sacroiliac joint RFA. Indeed, many of the clinical trials of sacroiliac joint denervation procedures, including those included in the evidentiary review literature packet, utilize patient sedation during SI joint denervation. Anything to add to that?
Sure. So I would say that it's, you know, that guidelines across the board, including the ASA, Pain Management Committee, ASRA Pain Medicine, SIS, all recommend against routine sedation for simple procedures such as sacroiliac joint blocks. That's not true for radiofrequency. The only study that really examined this was our study. It was a very strong crossover study, and in every single group, the parallel group, which had 73 patients, crossover and omnibus, sedation was associated with a much higher positive block rate. The ACIP guidelines are very flawed because they're based on Mangiaconti's work, and these people were all getting serial facet blocks, so they weren't getting radiofrequency. They were almost all on opioids. They had spine fusions, but they were getting facet blocks, and they didn't measure, they did not measure pain relief after the block. They gave them medication, and then they kind of asked them. There are several other studies that have looked at this. There's a group from Delaware. They did 2 studies. Basically, Cucuzella was the first one, and then Kim was the second one, and they concluded that, you know, that most people don't need routine sedation. And there's some evidence that using sedation for a diagnostic procedure is associated with poor outcomes for a definitive procedure. So Mike Erdick in 2010, this was for celiac plexus neurolysis. People who had sedation for the celiac plexus block, they had a 39% success rate, whereas 73% of people who did not have sedation had a success rate. And we have another study. It's actually impressive. I'm going over today the page proofs. It's about sympathetic blocks. And if you have sedation during the sympathetic block, 72% had greater than 50% pain relief. So they were diagnosed with sympathetically maintained versus 51% who did not receive sedation. The p-value is 0.051. So, like I say, the use of sedation, I'm sorry, I have a psychotic dog. The use of sedation, like I say, you know, is not only increased risks, increased costs, and, you know, undermines the validity of the diagnosis. But because it undermines the validity of the diagnosis, the definitive procedure is likely to be less successful. Over.
I believe that's well stated. I agree.
Thank you. Thanks for the thorough evidence and guideline search for that, because I know that's not necessarily easy to find either. So I appreciate your work, both of you. And further discussion on question 12. We're moving to question 13. We're almost there, everyone. Thanks for hanging in and your attention. I know we have a lot to cover, so I appreciate the, your attention. Dr. O'Brien and Brian Jacobs for question number 13.
Yeah, it said, the question is, what should the minimal level education training be to perform SI joint injections in RFA? And I did take a jab and sent out an email to everybody. But to be honest with you, I kind of rushed this a little bit. And if we look at the LCDs for Palmetto and probably I think some of the others are the same, they have a list there about provider qualifications. And I think the way that's worded, just changing it from facet joint injections and radiofrequency neuronomy to sacroiliac injections, lateral branch blocks, and sacroiliac radiofrequency ablation procedures, I think, just changing that wording, I think the current provider qualifications that you have in your LCDs, which I think just came out less than a year ago, last April 2021, is worded very appropriately. And it's very, I mean, it's very similar to what I wrote, but I think it's actually worded better.
Yeah, and I sent Dr. O'Brien my review, essentially the same thing. The wording there covers that there's an understanding, I mean, in addition to training, certification that's has oversight by some national accrediting organization. The language in there relates to understanding of the relevant anatomy, pharmacology, diagnosis and management of the underlying condition, technical performance of the procedure, management of complications, and safe utilization of associated imaging modalities. The only permutation I saw room for relative to what's already been published in some of the LCDs is that I imagine not all providers, and maybe this is different now because it's been around long enough, but are getting exposure to sacroiliac joint radiofrequency lesioning. And so the way the language states it in the other LCDs is that if you didn't get that in your formal training, then maybe you were unqualified to do it. So just so that there's enough wiggle room in there, because as pain science advances, we're getting new approaches and techniques, you know, strip lesioning with a single device versus like a palsy technique. Just as long as there's enough wiggle room in there that reasonable training would occur in the setting of like a continuing education setting for those providers who don't have that exposure.
Yeah, the current LCD regarding that, it says the basic requirement for payment is training and or credentialing by a formal residency fellowship program and or other training program that is accredited by a nationally recognized body and whose core curriculum includes the performance and management of these procedures addressed in the policy. I believe that's all reasonable. And obviously, providers need to be licensed to perform the procedures. So, I think I would just go back and look at your LCD for facet, and I think, you know, just changing it from facet to these procedures, it's going to fit very well.
Thank you both. Any other comments on training or education? Excellent. And we're on our last question, and then we'll have time for any questions from the CMDs or additional discussion. And so, Peter, if you could please share Dr. Guller's response to this question.
You got it, and it will be short and sweet. How common is it to need SI joint interventions bilaterally? The incidence of unilateral pain is often the hallmark of SI joint disease. The frequency of bilateral SI joint pain has been reported in the literature to be less than 10% of patients with SI joint disease. Of these 10% or less than 10%, the highest reported incidence are with ankylosing spondylitis and reactive psoriatic arthritis and conditions where the bilateral sacroiliitis are more common. Short and sweet.
I agree that SI joint pain, but I will say that there is a bimodal distribution, right? So younger people, you know, people in the military, athletes, they often have, you know, one-sided pain, unilateral pain. They have, you know, there's often trauma. And then you do have a subset of people who are, you know, who are older and they have osteoarthritis. And similar to people with knee osteoarthritis or hip osteoarthritis, you know, when it's mild, one side hurts more, and then it becomes, as it progresses, it becomes more severe, and both sides hurt and develop degeneration. So I do agree with that, but I think that there's definitely a subset of older people who have bilateral pain. Over.
Any other comments on question 14? So, without further comments on that question, I have a question for our experts in the panel, and I want to understand, so what would be the role of, I understand that, you know, a stepwise approach, so somebody that has pain and they get a diagnostic and or therapeutic injection, and they see improvement. How do you determine, and what is there evidence to support, when they get therapeutic injections? Like, how often would these be used as the primary treatment? So getting a therapeutic injection every 3 months for an unspecified amount of time versus moving to RFA?
Well, and that's kind of a little difficult to answer, but I think the problem is some physicians are scheduling people. So put it this way, if the policy says 3 months or it says 4 months, they're doing a procedure and then they're scheduling another procedure to come back with anticipated another injection 3 months later, when that's not the intent of the procedure or the policy. These typically state that you want to get 50% improvement in their pain and improved function for at least that amount of time. And in my experience, I almost never have anybody. I mean, if I did 2 injections a year, that'd be, you know, probably the most. I'm, you know, not doing them every 3 months. Well, we don't see the patient back unless their pain reoccurs, if they have a good therapeutic response. So I think that's how most honest doctors would approach this. But some patients are under the impression they need this for maintenance and so forth. So if they're getting them every 3 months regularly, then they're obviously not lasting 3 months. I mean, it's not like the pain just comes back exactly at the 3-month mark each time. So I don't know how you I'm not probably answering your question. So, I mean, that's not probably the rule of the coverage policy. That's probably the rule of Medicare acts and stuff to review the medical necessity of repeat injections. But, you know, like I said, from a diagnostic standpoint, so I think for facet, when we're doing medial branch block to diagnose, you can bring the patient back 2 weeks later to do the second block. And there's no reason not to do it 1 week later. So from a diagnostic, if you're doing purely diagnostic confirmatory block, there should not be any time limit necessarily when you repeat that, but I mean, 2 weeks is reasonable, not unreasonable. But for therapeutic, then, you know, I think the patient has to be reevaluated to determine the efficacy of previous therapeutic intervention. And so a lot of doctors will see somebody back a month or so later and determine the efficacy of the shot, and then if their pain comes back 6 months later or 2 years later, you bring them back and there's the same problem, repeat the thing that worked. So I'm not sure if I answered your question. I'm not sure how you wordsmith it in a policy, but I think the documentation to do a repeat therapeutic procedures just needs to document the duration of relief and percent pain relief. And whether that happened to be at the 3 or 4 month mark, then so be it. But I think it's atypical for people to, if the criteria is you can repeat them every 3 months, I think a very small, like less than 5% of patients should be getting 3 or 4 injections a year. I mean, the same thing with epidural injections. They've done studies where the average patient may only need 2 for disc herniation radiculitis, even though there may be outliers that are doing them make more than that because the policy may allow that. So I think as part of the documentation requirements and a coverage policy, like I said, for diagnostic blocks, I think it's good to make them document the percent pain relief at the time the procedure is completed. And then I have them obviously hard copies of the films to document, you know, unless they're allergic to contrast in the joint or the nerve, the block, lateral branch blocks or RF. I think you should consider if this is going to be standard practice, you know, for all payers to add the KX box, diagnostic box to differentiate it from a therapeutic block, are all probably reasonable things to incorporate to make it more clear to the providers how to approach this.
So this is Doug Beal. I've got a comment on bilaterality and unilaterality of the pain. So I don't necessarily agree with the vast majority of these are unilateral, but also the vast majority of my SI joint fusion patients have 5-1 fusions or longer segment fusions that cross 5-1. And most of the time they do present with unilateral pain, but then after that's treated, the other side starts to hurt as well. And so the biomechanical data on this shows pretty clearly that this is transmitted across both SI joints. There's a good meta-analysis done recently that shows this. And, yeah, so most of the time it's one side versus the other, but the cumulative effect of this is very, very commonly bilateral, especially after 5-1 fusion. And these are the exact patients that have SI pain. So I want to make sure we know that and make sure that's a situation where you can expect to have bilateral pain, and whether it's described as unilateral presentation or a cumulative effect as a bilateral patient, it needs to be parsed out, at least understood that that's often the case.
This is Stephen Cohen. I would say that most of the randomized trials, including ours and Dr. Patel's and this new 210 study patient, so they require people who get significant pain relief from the blocks and it does not last 3 months. But again, if you look at these other studies, right, if you look at the epidural steroid injection studies sponsored, you know, that are funded by the NIH, if you look at the FDA study with it's called the CLEAR trial, where they're looking to get pain relief, they designed this with the FDA. They determined that 1 month would be the primary outcome measure. And if you look at all those other SI joint studies, and I went over them, usually it's 4 weeks is the primary outcome measure. So, And again, you know, SI joint injections, not everybody, if you're an elderly person and you have osteoarthritis, you're probably not going to do well with radiofrequency ablation because you have osteoarthritis and you don't have ligamentous injury. There's also, you bring up the multi-specialty working group, and now they're putting together, they're close to finishing it, guidelines on the total steroid dose in a year. And I believe that the I'm not the chair of that, but I'm on that committee. I think it's Nori Benzon is the chair. I think it's about 200 milligrams per year. So you definitely need to limit the number of injections. I don't see a problem with 4 per year. Like I said, it's not an easy thing.
So in the facet literature, it was a little more clear in terms of, you know, therapeutic versus RFA. And with the SIJ literature, I don't think that there is a lot of literature to help answer who gets RFA versus who gets continued therapeutic injection. So is there any literature that helps to guide that? And if there's not, what are our experts' thoughts on how to make that call?
Well, if you already allow one therapeutic procedure to be repeated after 6 months with 50% relief, then at a minimum, they should allow a repeat therapeutic SI joint injection with 50% relief for cheaper and easier than an RFA. So that would be, that should be the minimum allowed, would be two injections a year. But these are injections and it's not RFA. So whether it's 3 months of improvement or 4 months of improvement, you know, I don't think any of us know the exact right number. And unfortunately, a lot of these people are getting treated with steroids for other problems, shoulder problems, other joint problems. Sometimes they may develop a disc herniation. So all these are concerns. But from a therapeutic standpoint, if you're allowing a repeat RFA at 6 months, then definitely would allow a repeat injection at 6 months because they're both therapeutic procedures and the injection is a lot cheaper. But I believe it is reasonable to repeat SI joint injection if they had, you know, in my opinion, greater than 3 months of improvement from a previous injection. I think having at least three injections a year is reasonable. Whether people would advocate for more than that, you know, for 90% of the population, I don't think it's probably needed more than that. There may be some outliers and small subsets of patients that may need more, that may have comorbidities where they wouldn't tolerate other interventions. I don't know, but I mean, if we're looking at the vast majority of patients, I think, you know, having up to three injections, therapeutic injections a year is reasonable in my opinion. If it keeps them functional and keeps their pain under.
And I just want to open the floor to our CMDs if they have additional questions or if any of our experts have additional comments that they want to share before we wrap up. Well, I think we went over a lot of information, and I very much appreciate all of our experts' time in preparing for this meeting and sharing your expertise with us, as well as the research on the evidence and your interpretation. I think you all did a wonderful job, and I very much appreciate each of you and your contributions to this process. And so one final call if anyone has any further questions. And if since I'm hearing silence, I think we'll be able to wrap up. And if I can just remind our experts, if you can please share any additional comments that you have on the questions within a week. And also, if you could please send me the references that you've mentioned throughout throughout our discussion to make sure that we have all of these references accurate as we continue to analyze this literature and work forward on this process. Thanks, everybody, again, and thanks for our audience for your attention. And a reminder to our jurisdictional CAC members that we welcome your comments. Please contact your local MACs to submit those. We will ask you to share that with a conflict of interest form. And thank you very much, everyone. I hope you have a wonderful afternoon and evening.
Good night. Thank you.
Today's conference.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Good night. Thank you.
Thank you.